ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, torrential rain and flash flooding set to hit New South Wales and Queensland. Emergency workers are preparing for a busy weekend. Also, the cost of filling up at the petrol bowser is set to rise as global oil prices surge. And it's 50 years since ABBA announced itself on the world stage.
The songs are so joyful, they're so catchy, they're so cross-generational, you know, like your grandma could sing along to that, but also your mum and your kids and your grandkids.
First tonight, residents of New South Wales and Queensland are bracing for possible flooding as heavy rains sweep across those states. Severe weather warnings are in place for some areas, and the State Emergency Service is warning people in New South Wales to stay inside. This report from Alexandra Humphreys.
On the northwestern fringe of Sydney, residents in the town of Windsor are no strangers to floods, having experienced six since 2020. As more heavy rain impacts the area along the Hawkesbury River, locals like Bill are hoping to avoid the worst by sandbagging ahead of time.
We get a bit of flood water, a bit of rain water that runs down a slope into our house, and last time we got it through our bedroom.
Bill is worried about what tonight will bring for people living in lower-lying areas.
They've been through it and it's pretty fresh in their minds, so they don't want to do all that work again. They lose all their possessions.
Last night, some parts of New South Wales recorded more than 100 millimetres of rain, including Sydney. But the worst is yet to come. Hundreds of millimetres could fall in just a few hours tonight, bringing the threat of flash flooding. Sarah McMahon is the mayor of Hawkesbury City. She says there are a vast number of homes and businesses at risk.
We have very concerned business owners who operate on the floodplain, our farmers and, of course, residents who have low-lying homes. So they're very concerned. The farmers are bringing up their pumps, moving cattle, and our homeowners are very worried because after the last six floods over the last few years, they have no insurance. So any damage done to their homes is going to come out of their own pocket. So there is a lot of anxiety in our community right now.
The Hawkesbury-Nepean River could see major flooding, and the Warragamba Dam is likely to begin spilling on Monday, which could cause further problems.
The problem is, as soon as there's another weather event, another week, 2 weeks, another month later, while we're sitting on a full dam, we basically are sitting here waiting for this to happen now every single time it rains. So we are very concerned.
Flood watches are in place for more than 40 rivers in New South Wales. Angus Hines is a senior meteorologist at the Weather Bureau.
There's a whole lot of flood watches covering pretty much all the rivers across eastern New South Wales, saying that there is rain on the way. We do expect this rain to fall across the river catchments and we do expect the river levels to rise.
Some places are already seeing the impacts. On the state's far northern coast, flash flooding forced the Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital and Sanctuary to evacuate its animals to higher ground. Russell Mills is the sanctuary's communications director.
It was quite remarkable how quickly the water rose. This was actually more significant for us, at least, than the 2022 floods that, that devastated the region. So all of our team members had hands on deck. They were carrying animals through, in some cases, thigh-deep water. To enclosures to get them to safety.
Flights have been cancelled, schools closed, and the SES have conducted at least seven rescues and responded to hundreds of incidents in New South Wales alone. But it's not just the wet weather causing concern. Deborah Platts is the Deputy SES Commissioner in New South Wales.
Well, with the intense rainfall, but also the very strong winds that are predicted, and those winds could be up to 90 kilometres per hour, and with that level of wind, we will expect trees to be uprooted and we will have structural damage to buildings.
Rain is still falling in southern and southeastern Queensland too. Major flooding is occurring in the Warrego River in the state's southwest, with flood watches issued for a number of others. Flood levees are being set up in Charleville ahead of an expected peak this evening, although floodwaters are likely to remain high for the next few days. Laura Bokel is a senior meteorologist.
Localised heavy falls could occur at times over the weekend, and the area where we're likely to see the most risk is the area south of Brisbane, so that includes Logan, Gold Coast and the scenic rim areas as well.
Flash flooding is occurring right across southern areas in Queensland. Brian Cox is from the SES.
What we're asking people to do is to remain vigilant. With the current weather conditions, flash flooding can occur in minutes, not hours or days.
There are also warnings for people planning to travel into parts of western Queensland. Roads could be cut off, leaving motorists trapped for days.
That report from Alexandra Humphreys. Overseas now, and Israel has announced it'll allow more aid into northern Gaza after the American President Joe Biden threatened to make his country's support for Israel conditional on it doing more to protect civilians and aid workers. Mr. Biden made his demands in what was reportedly a tense phone call with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Rima Chia has more.
In Gaza City, residents are carrying white bags with humanitarian aid in a hurry to reach their families. This man says he takes the risk of walking past Israeli army tanks for a little food.
We go there to risk dying and suffering for just 10 or 12 kilograms of flour. And how can this be enough for 16 or 17 people? How can aid distributions of 5 kilograms of flour for 17 or 20 people be enough?
Following an Israeli airstrike on a World Central Kitchen convoy that killed 7 aid workers, including Australian Zami Frankem, worldwide condemnation has been swift. The United States has told Israel that if it doesn't have a concrete plan to protect both civilians and aid workers in Gaza, its support will be withheld. Here's US National Security spokesman John Kirby.
There are things that need to be done. There are too many civilians being killed. The risk to aid workers is unacceptable. Now we have certain aid organizations that are reconsidering whether they're even going to be able to continue operations in Gaza while famine looms. So there has to be tangible steps. Let's see what they do. But I'm not going to get ahead of that.
Within hours of the ultimatum from the US, Israel approved the opening of 3 humanitarian routes into Gaza, despite its previous claims it has never restricted the amount of aid entering the strip. One border crossing, the Erez Gate in the north, will be temporarily reopened for the first time since the start of the war. Laura Blumenfeld is from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She says the nature of President Joe Biden's latest phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu marks a sharp shift in tone.
The relationship is changing, clearly. We've gone from a hug to a handshake to a slap on the wrist today. The policy has been speak softly and carry a big aircraft carrier. They've really been backing up their diplomacy with the threat of retaliation by the United States. So far, it's been one of the great successes of the past 6 months.
Ian Parmeter is from the Center of Arab and Islamic Studies at the ANU. He says while the attack on the aid convoy could prove to be a turning point, it likely won't completely slow down the supply of weapons to Israel.
Among the weaponry that the United States has been providing have been 1,000-pound bombs and 500-pound bombs. If the United States were to say it won't supply more of those, that actually could have an effect on Israel. And we're only about 8 months out from an election. Biden is limited in terms of the pressure that he can put on Israel.
For Palestinians in Gaza and around the world, the fact that it took the deaths of foreign aid workers to be a catalyst for the most serious international response yet is both disappointing and expected. Fahad Ali is a Palestinian community organiser.
You know, as a Palestinian, you have to wonder why this incident and not so many incidents before it, such as a massacre at El Shifa Hospital. Why did that not provoke any outrage or anger? So I'm not so much surprised, because many of these workers were citizens of, you know, Western nations, including Zomi Frankem, who was an Australian. And I suppose that means that people have some proximity and feel, you know, that they have personally been targeted. One of our own has been killed. But I think that to be a true humanist, we need to generalize that principle to an extent and extend our feelings and our empathy towards all people who are suffering within war.
He says Palestinian communities in Australia and globally have been rallying for months for a permanent ceasefire with little support from government figures.
In fact, Palestinians have known from the very, very beginning that what was going to happen is what we are seeing now. We were going to see a grossly asymmetric death toll. We were going to see wide-scale devastation, and we were going to see situations where people were being starved and aid workers were being targeted. This was all completely foreseeable.
The findings into the Israeli military's investigation will be released tomorrow.
Rima Cheer reporting. The Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, has visited Alice Springs today, but she's yet to say if a two-week youth curfew will be extended. The emergency measure was introduced because of worsening crime in the central Australian town and bans under 18s from being in the CBD at night time. As Gavin Coote reports, safety concerns have seen thousands of tourists cancel visits to the Alice this season.
So this is Terry.
Terry the saltwater crocodile and his home, the Alice Springs Reptile Centre, are usually big draw cards for tourists around this time of year.
Oi! Spit it!
Good boy.
But the owner, Rex Neindorf, has seen the worst Easter on record.
There's basically no one here, and it's about 1 o'clock, so we do three shows a day at 11, 1 and 3.30. We would normally have, over Easter, about 60 to 70 people at a show for three shows a day, and we did a fraction of that. You know, one show we had 10 people, one show we had 4 people, and that just should not happen.
While cost of living pressures and soaring airfares were already deterring visitors to Alice Springs, the recent coverage of crime and the town's youth curfew has been the final straw for some.
And yes, some of the big charter groups are looking at pulling out of Alice Springs, and there is a couple of reasons why they're doing that as well. It's not just the crime factor, it's also connectability of flights and a few other things involved. So when you put it all together, it makes it really bad. It's gone from being, you know, a set of big waves into a tsunami.
And it's only thanks to the GAN, the tourist train which stops in Alice Springs on its way from Adelaide to Darwin, that Rex Neindorf is able to hold on.
So we're lucky that we get the GAN in. If the GAN stopped coming tomorrow, I'd have to close my tourism side of the business down immediately. That's how much the GAN brings into us.
Easter is usually when the Alice Springs tourism season kicks off, but now the sector is bracing for a tough year. Daniel Rochford is the Chief Executive of Tourism Central Australia.
Oh, look, we're well over $1 million lost already in the last few days of cancellations to the region. This is certainly an unprecedented storm that our industry is having to face. And obviously we are very concerned about the future of this tourism season.
The two-week curfew will run until next Wednesday, and the NT government is yet to say whether it'll extend it. Police say the youth curfew has led to a significant reduction in crime and antisocial behaviour in Alice Springs. Tour operator and Arunda Kadich man Liam Reid supports the measure, even though it's hurting his industry.
Personally, I think the curfew was good. I think it's something that has helped. The only thing for the long run is don't know how well it's going to continue to keep going. I've grown up in Alice Springs all my life. Seeing how it was back then to where it is now, there's definitely been some big problems.
Liam Reid is with 100% Fink River Culture and Adventure, an Aboriginal-owned and operated tour guide company. Bookings remain strong. He's had a few cancellations this tourism season, but he feels for other operators in the region.
Some of these businesses have been here since from when I was a kid, and to see them no longer exist, all because of the bad stuff that's happening in town, it shouldn't be that way.
The sector is calling for financial support to keep Central Australia tour operators afloat. NT Chief Minister Eva Lawler has told ABC Alice Springs the government's looking at it closely.
We've obviously had it was international publicity around what we saw on Tuesday. More than happy for the Tourism Minister to have those conversations with the Tourism Central Australia. I met with them last week and heard loudly and clearly just how distraught and concerned they are around the tourism season. And we don't want that.
Could there be direct financial assistance?
As I said, all those options are always on the table. We want businesses to thrive in Alice Springs.
Despite the ongoing crisis and the concern around crime that's contributed to it, Liam Reid remains upbeat about the future.
Most of our clients come out wanting to actually find out the truth firsthand. they want to be out here and find out the true story of what's going on and not just keep being told what's all the negative stuff that's going on.
The NT government recently launched a discount scheme offering 25% off all bookings through the Territory's visitor information centres. It also points to its efforts to bring more airline routes to Central Australia from both Melbourne and Perth.
That report from Gavin Coote and Charmaine Allison in Alice Springs. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, bad news at the Bowser. Petrol prices are going up as the price of oil surges. The defamation case of Bruce Lehrman has finally wrapped up after it was reopened this week to hear sensational new evidence from Network 10. Mr. Lehrman, a former Liberal staffer, sued the broadcaster and its journalist Lisa Wilkinson after they aired an interview in which his former colleague Brittany Higgins alleged she'd been raped in Parliament House. Mr. Lehrman strongly denies any wrongdoing and no findings have been made against him. Over the last couple of days, the federal court has heard a number of allegations which Network 10 argues damage Mr. Lehrman's credibility as a witness. Patrick Bell is following the case. Patrick, the judge is being asked by Network 10 to consider two main issues stemming from this new evidence. What are they?
Well, Sam, the first is the disclosure of material to Channel 7 as part of its efforts to prepare the Spotlight program, which it alleges was provided by Bruce Lehrman in breach of court rules, because this material was provided after it was part of a brief of evidence in his criminal trial, but ultimately not tendered in court. And that provision, it says, was in breach of the usual practice around these things. Importantly, Bruce Lehrman had been asked about whether he had provided certain material to Channel 7 as part of this process. And he had said when he was being cross-examined last year that he had only given them an interview. So that's the reason 10 wanted to press this issue. The second issue that's been critical over the last few days is around some of the payments that the 7 Network is alleged to have made. We had some more evidence this morning from Taylor Auerbach, the former 7 producer who had been testifying over the last couple of days, about the invoice that Bruce Lehrman issued, which it was allegedly trying to recoup money he spent on illicit drugs and to engage sex workers. The court heard that there was an item listed as pre-production expenses for $750 on this invoice, and Taylor Auerbach said there were discussions about how that payment should be listed so that it would get through Channel 7's finance system, but that was the money Bruce Lehrman was seeking to replenish his bank account, and that money was in fact paid. Although it's important to note that he has not seen documentary evidence of that money being paid to Bruce Lehrman, but he has been told by Mr. Lehrman and by some other network staff that it was going through the process.
So, Patrick, what have the lawyers for each side had to say about why those two issues are so important?
It's essentially a question of credit and how credible the critical witnesses in this case are. And that's because the main fact that the judge is attempting to make a finding on is, of course, whether or not Bruce Lehrman did, as he is accused of doing, in raping Brittany Higgins at Parliament House in 2019. He, of course, denies that allegation, and there was a mistrial in the ACT Supreme Court that left no findings against him. But Network 10's barrister Matthew Collins has argued that this is another issue for Mr. Lehrman in terms of his overall credibility as a witness, and that given that's the core of his case, is the credibility of his account of what happened on that night in March 2019, that this is a very important consideration. Meanwhile, Mr. Lehrman's barrister, Matthew Richardson, has rejected suggestions that this is as important as Network 10 would argue. He has said that any evidence that perhaps Mr. Lehrman lied about providing some of the court material to Channel 7, or whether he lied about some of the benefits he received from Channel 7, it doesn't follow from that that he's then necessarily lying about everything, or in particular about the main material facts and the dispute over whether or not Ms. Higgins's allegation is true. So a couple of different conceptions as to how important this was.
So the judgment in this defamation case was meant to have been handed down yesterday. What's Justice Michael Lee's timeline now for the handing down of his decision?
He's indicated that a judgment will not happen early next week on Monday or Tuesday. He's got a not insignificant amount of work to do, in his words, to go through some of the extra evidence that has been presented to the court. But he hasn't necessarily walked back his optimism that he had expressed earlier this week, that a judgment could be coming as soon as next week. He has said he'll endeavour to let all of the parties know as soon as possible when he does arrive at a date, and concluded by saying that there was a symmetry of interest in getting this matter dealt with as quickly as possible.
Patrick Bell reporting. Motorists are being warned the price of petrol is set to climb steeply in the coming weeks. It follows a spike in the oil price today. It's now trading at its highest level since October last year. Analysts say the price is going up because of cuts to supply by OPEC, that's the Organisation of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, as well as concerns about rising tensions in the Middle East. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
The spike in the oil price has rattled international financial markets.
Oil going up, I mean, that's a big deal, and I think that's really what drove the market today.
The price of Brent crude, which helps determine what Australian motorists pay at the pump, rose 1.6% this morning to over $90 a barrel. It's the highest level since October last year. The ANZ Bank's senior commodities strategist, Daniel Hines, says the oil price has been rising steadily for 6 months.
The gradual nature of the recent performance, I suppose, doesn't bring to mind, you know, the screaming headlines that you would normally get with such sort of level.
At the heart of higher oil prices, says Daniel Hines, is the concern that other big oil-producing countries will be drawn into the Hamas-Israel conflict.
It's been something I've been focusing on for quite some time, and sort of been concerned, about its possible escalation, and now that it's happening,
because the oil price is effectively saying it is escalating.
Exactly. I think it's getting to a point where there is real concern now, and I think the market's probably, or the broader sort of market, hasn't really picked up on those issues just yet.
He says he expects the oil price to climb further in coming weeks.
The market is relatively tight, and we have OPEC, the world's biggest producing group, as a whole, continuing to constrain supply, even though there's these risks to disruptions within the Middle East. And, you know, the consumption or demand for oil is getting better, particularly in markets like the US and in China. So, yes, I think it's got a little bit further to go, at least over the next few months.
So what does all this mean for the price of petrol at the pump? Well, as a general rule of thumb, the price at the Bowser rises roughly 10 cents per litre for every $1 increase in the oil price.
Look, I think we'll clearly see prices rise over the next few weeks. As I said, I think there'll probably be a 1 to 2 week lag from the recent rally. We could see it clearly back over $2 a litre, at least here in New South Wales in the next few weeks.
Peter Curry is a spokesperson for insurance and motoring organisation NRMA. He says he also expects petrol prices to start climbing.
Since Easter, the average price in Sydney has been around the high 180s. It will creep above $1.90 if it hasn't done so already. And then it will continue to rise on account of the price cycle in other parts of the country, you know, depending on where you live. And so that'll probably happen in the next week or two, probably over the next 7 to 10 days.
It sounds like, though, you're more referring to the petrol price cycle in itself as opposed to the higher oil price leading to higher petrol prices.
So the two are combined. The two are connected. As the oil price goes up, the high point of the cycle will also increase. And that's why we're expecting the next high point in Sydney to go above $2.10 a litre, which it didn't do previously. And if these increases continue, because not just the global oil prices are going up, but the wholesale price is also going up, then that $2.12 mark could also go even higher, depending on what happens with both oil prices and the wholesale price.
Well, Peter Curran, not putting too fine a point on it, but it wouldn't be so silly for motorists to fill up this afternoon.
We would absolutely encourage motorists to fill up. So if you haven't filled up yet, if you missed out on the bottom of the cycle before Easter, don't delay any longer, because those prices are just going to go up every day.
That's NRMA spokesman Peter Currie ending David Taylor's report. Well, tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of a sparkling moment in pop music history when the legendary band ABBA unexpectedly won the Eurovision contest with Waterloo, a song that went on to be one of their greatest hits. Few Australians had even heard of the Swedish band or Eurovision before 1974, but the win helped start our long-standing love of the supergroup. Our reporter John Daly takes us back to the white satin, glitter and catchy choruses of that memorable year.
Half a century ago, a satin-clad band from Sweden stepped out onto the stage at the Eurovision Song Contest and made music history. ABBA's performance of Waterloo took the competition by storm, and the flares and the sparkles and euphoric sound captivated the world. And Waterloo topped the charts in many countries, cracking the top 10 in Australia.
I mean, it's such a joyous song. I think that's probably what most people might relate to about ABBA, is that their songs are so joyful, they're so catchy, they're so cross-generational, you know? Like, your grandma could sing along to that, but also your mum and your kids and your grandkids. And there's just something so accessible about their music.
That's Dr. J.D. O'Regan, who's a lecturer in contemporary music at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. She says ABBA helped lay the foundations of disco music and fused the more traditional pop songwriting with the flamboyance of the glam rock of the early 1970s. The band's unique female vocals and unusual lyrics made it a musical movement of its own.
You know, English is a second language, so the kinds of things they would write or phrases they would use might not necessarily be the ones that, like, a native English speaker as their first language would say. And I think that's part of what their charm is. And so Waterloo's an interesting one, because they're literally using, like, the Battle of Waterloo as a metaphor for sort of falling in love or surrendering to a relationship, which is such a bonkers concept for a love song.
Not many Australians knew of ABBA or the Eurovision Song Contest before 1974, but ABBA fever soon swept the country with the help of Molly Meldrum on Countdown.
Now, 14 months ago, ABBA were only known in Sweden, which is absolutely amazing. And since then, they've become the biggest record sellers in Australia. They've caught the imagination of toddlers, teenagers and grandmothers alike.
The music has endured the test of time, and decades later, another generation of Australians would fall for ABBA.
I'm not alone. I'm with Muriel.
And now let's hear a warm welcome.
The beloved 1994 comedy, Muriel's Wedding, again reignited the love affair. J.D. O'Regan again.
Lots of ABBA songs in that film, and that was such an iconic Australian film. It sort of tied Australian culture with their music, and that's probably continued ever since. So, yeah, I mean, I think we just like good pop music.
And on the streets of Perth, people still have wonderful memories of that music in their lives.
It was like my first love was my first impression of falling in love with a girl was about listening to an ABBA song, yeah.
Year 12 at Scarborough Senior High School, which is no more. We had a video production done singing along to an ABBA song. The whole class just erupted.
My friends, when they have a party, it's always an ABBA party if you're going to dress up. You know, people remember them. They're just wonderful.
Hell awesome. Yeah, we've got them on a playlist for my gym. I reckon I've got ABBA Gold and ABBA Arrival complete on my playlist. I love it. It's great. It gets me moving.
John Daly with that report, and I hope it's made you want to pull out some old LPs and put your dancing shoes on. That's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Lena Elsardi, David Sargent, David Lawford and Nick Dracoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. The PM team will be back on Monday evening. Just a reminder, you can find the podcast of the program on the ABC Listen app. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Israel says it was a mistake, but how does a military manage to bomb a clearly marked aid convoy? Today, a longtime aid worker, Tim Costello, on why no one trying to deliver aid in Gaza is safe and what the world should do about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.